equipped, but cowed and undermanned Saudi military. One battalion of the Saudi National Guard, fewer than 1,000 men, guarded the oil fields. The royal family was so shocked that it forced the government-controlled media to wait a week before announcing the invasion. Moreover, after years of paying billions of dollars to cultivate the friendship of neighboring countries, the royal family was stunned to discover how isolated it was in the Arab world. The Palestinians, Sudanese, Algerians, Libyans, Tunisians, Yemenis, and even the Jordanians openly supported Saddam Hussein. With the Iraqi army poised on the Saudi border, bin Laden wrote a letter to the king beseeching him not to call upon the Americans for protection. He followed this with a frenzied round of lobbying the senior princes. The royal family itself was divided about the best course of action, with Crown Prince Abdullah strongly opposing American assistance, and Prince Naif seeing no obvious alternative. The Americans had already made a decision, however. If, after snacking on Kuwait, Saddam gobbled up the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, he would then control the bulk of the world's available oil supply. That was an intolerable threat to the security of the United States, not just the kingdom. U.S. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney flew to Jeddah with a team of advisors, including General Norman Schwarzkopf, to persuade the king to accept American troops to defend Saudi Arabia. Schwarzkopf showed satellite images of 3 armored Iraqi divisions inside Kuwait, followed by ground troops, far more manpower, he contended, than the number needed to occupy such a small country. The Saudis had intelligence that several Iraqi reconnaissance teams had already crossed the Saudi border. Crown Prince Abdullah advised against letting the Americans enter the country for fear they would never depart. In the name of the President of the United States, Cheney pledged that the troops would leave as soon as the threat was over, or whenever the king said they should go. That promise decided the matter. "Come with all you can bring," the king implored. "Come as fast as you can." In early September, weeks after American forces began arriving, bin Laden spoke to Prince Sultan, the Minister of Defense, in the company of several Afghan Mujahideen commanders and Saudi veterans of that conflict. It was a bizarre and grandiose replication of General Schwarzkopf's briefing. Bin Laden brought his own maps of the region and presented a detailed plan of attack, with diagrams and charts indicating trenches and sand traps along the border, to be constructed with the Saudi bin Laden group's extensive inventory of earth-moving equipment. Added to this, he would create a Mujahideen army made up of his colleagues from the Afghan Jihad and unemployed Saudi youth. "I am ready to prepare 100,000 fighters with good combat capability within 3 months," bin Laden promised Prince Sultan. "You don't need Americans. You don't need any other non-Muslim troops. We will be enough." "There are no caves in Kuwait," the prince observed. "What will you do when he lobs missiles at you with chemical and biological weapons?" "We will fight him with faith," bin Laden responded. Bin Laden also made his presentation to Prince Turki. He was one of the few princes who had agreed with bin Laden's assessment of Saddam as a threat to the kingdom. In fact, over the years, Turkey had made several proposals to the CIA about removing Saddam through covert means, but each time he was spurned. When the invasion of Kuwait occurred, Turkey had been in Washington, D.C. on vacation. He was in a theater watching Die Hard 2 when he was summoned to the White House. He spent the rest of the night at the Central Intelligence Agency helping to coordinate the campaign to repel the Iraqis from Kuwait. In his opinion, if Saddam were allowed to stay in Kuwait, he would enter the kingdom at the slightest provocation. So when bin Laden approached him with his plan, Turkey was taken aback by the naivete of the young Afghan veteran. There were only 58,000 men in the entire Saudi army. Iraq, on the other hand, had a standing army of nearly 1 million men, the 4th largest army in the world, not counting its reserves and paramilitary forces. Saddam's armored corps counted 5,700 tanks, and his Republican Guards included the most fearsome and well-trained divisions in the Middle East. That did not impress bin Laden. "We pushed the Soviets out of Afghanistan," he said. The prince laughed in disbelief. For the first time, he was alarmed by the radical changes he saw in bin Laden's personality. He had gone from being a calm, peaceful, and gentle man, whose only goal was to help Muslims, to being a person who believed that he would be able to amass and command an army to liberate Kuwait. It revealed his arrogance and his haughtiness. Spurned by the government, bin Laden turned to the clergy for support. His case against American assistance rested on the prophet's remark as he lay dying, "Let there be no two religions in Arabia." The meaning of this remark has been disputed ever since it was uttered. Prince Turki argued that the prophet meant only that no other religion should dominate the peninsula. Even during the prophet's lifetime, he pointed out, Jews and Christians were traveling through Arabia. It was not until 641 CE, the 20th year of the Muslim calendar, that Caliph Omar began removing the indigenous Christians and Jews from some parts of Arabia. They were resettled in Iraq, Syria, and Palestine. Since then, the holy cities of Mecca and Medina have been off-limits for non-Muslims. To bin Laden and many other Islamists, that wasn't enough. They believe that the Prophet's deathbed injunction is clear. All non-Muslims should be expelled from the entire peninsula. Nonetheless, recognizing the danger that the foreign troops posed to their legitimacy, the Saudi government pressured the clergy to issue a fatwa endorsing the invitation of non-Muslim armies into the kingdom, on the excuse that they were defending Islam. This would give the government the religious cover it needed. Bin Laden furiously confronted the senior clerics. "This is inadmissible," he told them. "My son Osama, we cannot discuss this issue because we are afraid," one of the sheikhs replied, pointing to his neck and indicating that his head would be cut off if he talked about the matter. Within weeks, 500,000 American GIs streamed into the kingdom, creating what many Saudis feared would be a permanent occupation. Although the Americans and other coalition forces were stationed mainly outside the cities in order to stay out of view, Saudis were mortified by the need to turn to Christians and Jews to defend the holy land of Islam. That many of these foreign soldiers were women only added to their embarrassment. The weakness of the Saudi state and its abject dependence on the West for protection were paraded before the world, thanks to the 1,500 foreign journalists who descended on the kingdom to report on the build-up to the war. For such a private and intensely religious people, with a press that had been entirely under government control, the scrutiny was disorienting, at times both shameful and exhilarating. There was a combustible atmosphere of fear, outrage, humiliation, and xenophobia. But instead of rallying behind their imperiled government, many Saudis saw this as a one-time-only opportunity to change it. At this awkward moment in Saudi Arabia's history, with the world peering through the windows, Saudi progressives were sufficiently emboldened to press their modest agenda. In November, 47 women decided it was time to challenge the kingdom's informal ban on female driving. As it turned out, there was no actual law forbidding it. The women met in front of the Safeway in Riyadh and ordered their drivers out of their cars, then took a defiant 15-minute spin through the capital city. A policeman stopped them, but he had no legal reason to hold them. Prince Naif instantly banned the practice, however, and Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Baz, the chief cleric, helpfully added a fatwa, calling female driving a source of depravity. The women lost their passports, and several of them, who had been professors in the Women's College of King Saud University, were fired after their own female students protested that they did not want to be taught by infidels. In December, reformers circulated a petition requesting an end to discrimination based on tribal affiliation, the establishment of a traditional council of advisors to the king, called a shura, more press freedom, the introduction of certain basic laws of governance, and some kind of oversight on the proliferation of religious fatwas. A few months later, the religious establishment fired back with its own vehement letter of demands. It was an open bid for Islamic control of the kingdom, containing a barely disguised attack on the predominance of the royal family. The 400 religious scholars, judges, and professors who signed the letter called for strict conformity with the Sharia throughout society, including a ban on the payment of interest, the creation of an Islamic army through universal military training, and purifying the media in order to better serve Islam. The royal family was more shocked by this letter than by Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. Many of the demands of the religious dissidents echoed those of the leaders of the 1979 attack on the Grand Mosque. They became the basis of bin Laden's political agenda for the kingdom. The American mission quickly grew from protecting Saudi Arabia to repelling the Iraqis from Kuwait. The war began on January 16, 1991. By then, most Saudis were resigned to the presence of the Americans and the troops of 34 other countries that formed the coalition against Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of Kuwaiti citizens had taken refuge in the kingdom, and they told affecting stories about the looting of their country, the kidnapping, torture, and murder of civilians, and the rape of Kuwaiti women by the Iraqi troops. When Iraqi Scud missiles began raining down, however fecklessly, on Riyadh, even the Islamists held their tongues. But to many Saudis, the presence of the foreign crusaders, as bin Laden characterized the coalition troops, in the sanctuary of Islam, posed a greater calamity than the one that Saddam was already inflicting on Kuwait. Tonight in Iraq, Saddam walks amidst ruin. President George H.W. Bush was able to boast on March the 6th. His war machine is crushed. His ability to threaten mass destruction is itself destroyed. Although Saddam remained in power, that seemed to be a footnote to the awesome display of American military force and the international coalition that rallied behind U.S. leadership. The president was exultant. With the fall of the Soviet Union followed by this lightning victory, American hegemony was undisputed. "We can see a new world coming into view," Bush told Congress, "in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order. A world where the United Nations, freed from Cold War stalemate, is poised to fulfill the historic vision of its founders. A world in which freedom and respect for human rights find a home among all nations." These words, uttered so hopefully, found a bitter audience in Osama bin Laden. He also wanted to create a new world order, one that was ruled by Muslims, not dictated by America and enforced by the UN. The scale of his ambition was beginning to reveal itself. In his fantasy, he would enter history as the savior of Islam. Bin Laden waged a high-level campaign to retrieve his passport. He argued that he needed to return to Pakistan in order to help mediate the civil war among the Mujahideen, which the Saudi government was keenly interested in resolving. "There's a role I can play," bin Laden pleaded. Many prominent princes and sheikhs interceded on his behalf. Eventually, Prince Naif backed down and returned bin Laden's travel documents, but only after making the nettlesome warrior sign a pledge that he would not interfere with the politics of Saudi Arabia or any Arab country. In March 1992, bin Laden arrived in Peshawar. In the 3 years since his departure, the communist government in Afghanistan had managed to hang on to power, but it was on the verge of being overrun. Rival Mujahideen forces led by Ahmad Shah Massoud and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar were already engaged in a bloody struggle to determine who was going to seize power. The great powers that had chosen to use Afghanistan as a venue for the existential battle between communism and capitalism were notably absent in the chaotic aftermath of the war. Prince Turki hoped to establish a provisional government in Afghanistan that would unite the warring commanders and stabilize the country. He led the negotiations in Peshawar along with Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Worried about the influence of Iran on Afghanistan's western border, Turkey was inclined to support the more intransigent and fundamentalist Sunni elements, led by Hekmatyar. Bin Laden, on the other hand, attempted to play the role of the honest broker. He arranged a telephone conference call between Massoud and Hekmatyar, in which he begged Hekmatyar to come to the bargaining table. Hekmatyar was unyielding, knowing, no doubt, that he had Turkey's blessing. But in the middle of the night, Massoud's forces slipped into the city. The next morning, the surprised Hekmatyar furiously lobbed rockets into Kabul and began the siege of the capital. The Afghan civil war had begun. By opposing Turkey in the negotiations, Bin Laden believed that he had crossed a line. He told some of his companions that Saudi Arabia had recruited Pakistani intelligence to kill him. The old alliances formed by the jihad were falling apart. He and Prince Turki were now deadly antagonists. Before he left Afghanistan, Bin Laden put on a disguise and checked into a clinic in Karachi for some unknown ailment. His doctor, Zawahiri, was in Yemen, but they would soon be reunited. Chapter 8. Paradise. Although the fighting never paused after the fall of Kabul, the curtain came down on the Afghan jihad. Some Arabs remained, caught up in the civil war, but most of them moved on. They were largely unwelcome in their home countries, which had perceived them as misfits and extremists even before they went to Afghanistan. These same governments had advertised for young men to go to jihad and subsidize their travel, hoping that the troublemakers would bleed away in a doomed cause. Little thought was given to the prospect of thousands of these young men returning, now trained in guerrilla warfare tactics and empowered by the myth of their victory. Like any returning warriors, they brought home psychological problems and memories that were difficult to live with. Even those who had little actual experience of combat were indoctrinated with the culture of martyrdom and takfir. They strutted around the mosque, often wearing Afghan garb to signal their special status. Saudi intelligence guessed that between 15 and 25,000 Saudi youths trained in Afghanistan, although other estimates are far lower. Those who came back to the kingdom were taken directly to jail for 2 or 3 days of interrogation. Some countries simply refused to let the fighters return. They became a stateless, vagrant mob of religious mercenaries. Many of them took root in Pakistan, marrying local women and learning to speak Urdu. Some went to fight in Kashmir, Kosovo, Bosnia, or Chechnya. The cinders of the Afghan conflagration were drifting across the globe, and soon much of the Muslim world would be aflame. For those free-floating but ideologically charged veterans, a new home awaited them. In June 1989, at the same time that the jihad was ending in Afghanistan, Islamists staged a military coup d'etat against the civilian democratic government of Sudan. The leader of the coup was Brigadier General Omar Hassan al-Bashir, but the prime mover was Hassan al-Turabi, one of Africa's most complex, original, charismatic, and devious characters. Like Bin Laden and Zawahiri, Turabi attributed the failures of the Arab world to the fact that its governments were insufficiently Islamic and too dependent on the West. But unlike those other men, Turabi was a Quranic scholar who was well acquainted with Europe and the United States. A Sudanese student in 1960, he wandered across America, staying with ordinary families, even with Red Indians and farmers. An adventure that would inform his piercing critique of secularism and capitalism. He had gained his master's degree in law from the London School of Economics in 1961 and a doctorate in law from the Sorbonne in Paris 3 years later. Turabi envisioned the creation of an international Muslim community, the Ummah, headquartered in Sudan, which would then spill into other countries, carrying the Islamist revolution in an ever-widening circle. Sudan, until then a cultural backwater in the Muslim world, would be the intellectual center of this reformation and Turabi its spiritual guide. In order to carry out this plan, he opened the doors of his country to any Muslim, regardless of nationality, no questions asked. Naturally, the people who responded to his invitation tended to be those who were welcome nowhere else. The government of Sudan began its courtship of bin Laden by sending him a letter of invitation in 1990, and followed it up by dispatching several members of the Sudanese intelligence service to meet with him. Essentially, he was being offered an entire country in which to operate freely. At the end of that year, bin Laden sent 4 trusted associates to investigate the business opportunities that the Sudanese government had promised. Turabi dazzled these representatives with his erudition, and they brought back an enthusiastic report. "What you are trying to do, it is Sudan," they told bin Laden. "There are people with minds, with professions. You're not mixing with the goats." Soon, another bin Laden emissary appeared in Khartoum with a bundle of cash. Jamal al-Fadl, a Sudanese member of al-Qaeda, rented a number of houses and bought several large parcels of land that would be used for training. Al-Jihad was already in Sudan, and Zawahiri personally gave Fadl $250,000 to buy a farm north of the capital. The neighbors began complaining about the sound of explosions coming from the untilled fields. As an additional inducement, the Saudi bin Laden group got the contract to build an airport in Port Sudan, which brought Osama frequently into the country to oversee the construction. He finally moved to Khartoum in 1992, flying from Afghanistan with his 4 wives and, at that point, 17 children. He also brought bulldozers and other heavy equipment, announcing his intention to build a 300-kilometer road in eastern Sudan as a gift to the nation. The leader of Sudan greeted him with garlands of flowers. 2 men with such similar dreams as bin Laden and Turabi could scarcely be more different. As terse and laconic as bin Laden was, Turabi was fluent and endlessly theoretical, a brilliant windbag. He held soirees in his house, where on any evening heads of state or distinguished clerics would be perched on the green corduroy settees pressed against the walls of Turabi's salon, drinking tea and listening to his prolonged monologues. He could speak without pause for hours, unprompted except for the presence of an audience, gesturing with both hands and punctuating his witticisms with nervous laughter. He was slight and very dark, which, contrasted with his immaculate white robe and turban and his bright, toothy grin, made him appear all the more vivid. Nearly every month, bin Laden would attend one of these events, more out of courtesy than curiosity. He disagreed with almost everything Turabi said, but he was no match for the professor in his drawing room. The Islam that Turabi was straining to create in such a radical, non-democratic fashion was, in fact, surprisingly progressive. Turabi advocated healing the ancient breach between the Sunni and the Shia branches of Islam, which was heresy in bin Laden's eyes. Turabi spoke about integrating art, music, singing into religion, offending bin Laden's Wahhabi sensibilities. Early in his career, Turabi had made his reputation as an Islamic thinker by his advocacy of women's rights. He thought that Muslim women had suffered a long retreat from the comparative equality they once enjoyed. The Prophet himself used to visit women, not men, for counseling and advice. They could lead prayer, even in his battles. They are there. In the election between Uthman and Ali, to determine who will be the successor to the Prophet, they voted. Now that he was finally living in a radical Islamist state, bin Laden would ask practical questions, such as how the Islamists intended to apply Sharia in Sudan, and how they proposed to handle the Christians in the south. Often he did not like the answers. Turabi told him that Sharia would be applied gradually, and only on Muslims, who would share power with Christians in a federal system. Bin Laden would stay 10 to 30 minutes and then slip away. He couldn't wait to get out of there. "This man is a Machiavelli," Bin Laden confided to his friends. "He doesn't care what methods he uses." Although they still needed one another, Tarabi and Bin Laden soon began to see themselves as rivals. Khartoum began as the happiest period in Bin Laden's adult life. He opened a small downtown office on Mek Nimer Street in a sagging, single-story building with 9 rooms, a low ceiling, and a heavy air conditioner that dripped on the sidewalk. Here, he started Wadi al-Aqiq, the holding company for his many enterprises, named after a river in Mecca. Across the street was the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, in a building that had been a famous brothel during the British occupation. "Osama just laughed when I told him that," recalled Hassan Tarabi's son, Issam. Bin Laden and Issam became friends because of their common passion, riding. There are 4 million horses in Sudan, a country that relies on them for transportation and farm work, but loves them for sport. Although Issam was only 25 when Bin Laden arrived in Sudan, he was already one of the country's top breeders, and he kept a stable at the Khartoum track. One Friday, Bin Laden came shopping for a mare, and Issam showed him around the fly-ridden stalls. Issam was very struck by his Saudi visitor. He was not tall, but he was handsome. His eyes, his nose, he was beautiful. Bin Laden settled on a stately thoroughbred from another breeder, and Issam arranged to buy the horse without asking a commission. Bin Laden was so used to people taking advantage of his money that this simple courtesy impressed him. He decided to quarter his horses with Issam. He added 4 more Sudanese thoroughbreds for himself and bought his children about 10 local horses, which he bred to some Arabians he had flown in from the kingdom. Issam was disdainful of what he saw as Bin Laden's romantic attachment to native stock. "Here, we are trying to go toward the thoroughbred, away from the Arabian," but he wanted to establish a breeding scheme of his own. The Khartoum track is a chaotic bowl of dust. Wild dogs romp across the grassless infield, chasing after the horses. The rickety grandstand is divided between the lower half, where the common people stand, and the upper half, with the superior view, where the social elite and horse owners sit in relative comfort. Osama insisted on watching the races in the lower part, even though Issam was on the track's board of directors and enjoyed a prime box. In Sudan, the races are wild and the audiences are boisterous, given to dancing and singing. The famous Mujahid would plug his ears with his fingers whenever the band played. It ruined the experience for him. When he asked people to stop singing, they told him to get lost. "It's not your fault the music is there," Issam would gently remind Bin Laden. "You didn't rent the band." Bin Laden was unappeased. "Music," he declared, "is the flute of the devil." Eventually, he stopped coming to the races altogether. He bought a 3-story red stucco villa in a district of Khartoum called Riyadh. Across the unpaved street, he acquired an unfurnished guest house that he used for entertaining. The neighbors claimed he received 50 people a day, starting at 5 in the afternoon. Most of them Arabs wearing calf-length thobes and long beards, a parade of fundamentalists. His barefoot young sons would pass among the men, offering sweetened hibiscus tea. Every day he slaughtered a lamb for his expected visitors, but he ate very little himself, preferring to nibble what his guests left on their plates, believing that these abandoned morsels would gain the favor of God. Sometimes Bin Laden would take his sons for picnics on the shore of the Nile, with sandwiches and sodas, and in the packed sand along the riverbank he taught them to drive. Bin Laden adopted humble Sudanese attire, a white turban and galabeah, and he carried a typical walking stick with a V-shaped handle. "He was becoming Sudanese," Issam observed. It seemed he wanted to stay here forever. Bin Laden was finally at peace. He kept members of Al-Qaeda busy working in his burgeoning enterprises, since there is little else for them to do. On Fridays after prayers, the two Al-Qaeda soccer teams squared off against each other. There was training going on, but at a low level, mainly refresher courses for men who had already been in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda had become largely an agricultural organization. In Sudan, bin Laden had the opportunity to imitate his father's career as a road builder and businessman. He was the great Islamic investor, as Tarabi called him at a reception he gave soon after bin Laden arrived. Although it was true that he was Sudan's major tycoon, he was also practically the only one. The Sudanese dinar was sinking and the government was constantly in arrears. The ongoing civil war between the largely Arab Islamic North and the black Christian South was draining the treasury and scaring away investors, who were already appalled by the confluence of terrorists and the experimental nature of Islamist rule. That bin Laden was willing to put his money into such an economy made him all the more prized. Exaggerated rumors about his wealth were circulating. People said that he was investing $350 million or more in the country, which would certainly be its salvation. It was said that he capitalized a bank with $50 million, which was well beyond his financial capacity. Through Al-Hijra, his construction company, bin Laden built several major roads in Sudan, including one to Port Sudan. When the government was unable to pay him, he took large plots of land and trade. One parcel alone was larger than Bahrain, he bragged to his brothers. The government also threw in a tannery in Khartoum, where bin Laden's employees prepared leather for the Italian market. Another bin Laden venture, Al-Qararat, imported trucks and machinery from Russia and Eastern Europe. But it was farming that captivated his imagination. The government barter had made him perhaps the largest landowner in the country. He had 1 million acres in the Gash River Delta in northeast Sudan, a large plot in Gedarif, the most fertile province in the eastern section, and another in Damazine, which lies along the western bank of the Blue Nile, near the Ethiopian border. Through his agricultural company, Al-Thimar al-Mubaraka, bin Laden enjoyed a near monopoly on Sudan's major farm exports, sesame, white corn, and gum arabic. Other bin Laden subsidiaries produced sorghum, honey, peanuts, chickens, livestock, and watermelons. He declared that Sudan could feed the entire world if it were properly managed, and to prove the point, he showed off a prized sunflower he had grown in Gedarif. It could be in the Guinness Book of World Records, he told the Minister of State. He was a comparatively generous employer by Sudanese standards, paying $200 per month to most of his workers, with senior managers making from $1,000 to $1,500. He imposed corporate management techniques on his organization, requiring that forms be filled out in triplicate to purchase tires, for instance. Those employees who were actual members of Al-Qaeda received a monthly bonus between $50 and $120, depending on the size of the member's family and his nationality. Saudis got more and Sudanese got less, along with free housing and medical care. There were about 500 people working for bin Laden in Sudan, but there were never more than 100 of them who were active members of Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden shied away from the intractable conflict in the southern region of Sudan that was costing the impoverished Sudanese government $1 million a day and would eventually claim more than 1 million lives. Issam, a veteran, considered the war a jihad, and it seemed wrong to him that the famous Islamic warrior held himself apart from it. Bin Laden explained that he was through with warfare. He said he resolved to quit Al-Qaeda altogether and become a farmer. He made similar statements to many of his friends. He was at a crossroads. Life in Sudan was pleasantly monotonous. In the mornings, he walked to his local mosque to pray. Followed by a gaggle of acolytes and admirers, he lingered to study with the holy men, often breakfasting with them before going to his office, or to visit one of the various factories that were part of his expanding portfolio, or to hop on a tractor and plow the fields on one of his massive estates. Although he was the CEO of a burgeoning empire, he continued his lifelong habit of fasting on Mondays and Thursdays. Before Friday prayers, he would sometimes speak in the main Khartoum mosque, urging his fellow Muslims to discover the blessings of peace. There was one galling fact that prevented bin Laden from relaxing into the life of business and of spiritual contemplation that so strongly beckoned: the continued presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia. King Fahd had pledged that the non-believers would be gone as soon as the war was over. And yet months after the Iraqi defeat, coalition forces were still entrenched in Saudi air bases, monitoring the ceasefire agreement. Bin Laden agonized over what he believed was a permanent occupation of the Holy Land. Something had to be done. Coincidentally, American troops were stopping over in Yemen on their way to Somalia. The famine had drawn international attention, and the United States sent a modest force to protect the United Nations aid workers against the marauding local clans. The strategists in Al-Qaeda felt encircled, however, and they read this latest development as a direct assault. Americans already controlled the Persian Gulf, and now they were using the excuse of the famine in Somalia to occupy the Horn of Africa. Yemen and Somalia were the gatepost to the Red Sea, which could easily be pinched off. After all the plans Al-Qaeda had nurtured to spread an Islamist revolution, it was America that appeared to be waxing in influence across the region, seizing control of the pressure points of the Arab world, and pushing into Al-Qaeda's arena. The net was closing. Sudan could be next. This thinking took place at a time when the United States had never heard of Al-Qaeda. The mission to Somalia was seen as a thankless act of charity, and Sudan was too inconsequential to worry about. Every Thursday evening, Al-Qaeda members would gather in bin Laden's Khartoum guesthouse to hear lectures from their leaders. On one of these Thursdays, at the end of 1992, they discussed the threat of the expanded U.S. presence. Al-Qaeda, as a terrorist organization, was really born in the decisions that bin Laden and his Shura Council would make in this brief period when bin Laden was wavering, the lure of peace being as strong as the battle cry of jihad. Bin Laden's religious advisor was his close friend Mamdou Salem, also known as Abu Hajar al-Iraqi. He was a dashing, hard-headed Kurd who made a striking impression on everyone he met, solemn and imperious, with a trim goatee and penetrating black eyes. Abu Hajar had been a colonel in Saddam's army during the war with Iran, specializing in communications, until he deserted and fled to Iran. He and bin Laden were the same age, 34, in 1992. They had worked together in the Services Bureau in Peshawar and fought together in Afghanistan, forging such powerful bonds that no one could get between them. Unlike nearly everyone around bin Laden in Sudan, Abu Hajar had never sworn fealty to him. He saw himself as an equal, and bin Laden treated him as such. Because of his piety and learning, Abu Hajar led the prayers, his voice singing the verses of the Quran in a melancholy Iraqi style, was so lyrical that it made bin Laden weep. Besides being bin Laden's friend, Abu Hajar was his imam. There were remarkably few among the members of Al-Qaeda who had any extensive religious training. Despite their zealotry, they were essentially theological amateurs. Abu Hajar had the greatest spiritual authority by virtue of having memorized the Quran, but he was an electrical engineer, not a cleric. Nonetheless, bin Laden made him head of Al-Qaeda's fatwa committee, a fateful choice. It was on Abu Hajar's authority that Al-Qaeda turned from being the anti-communist Islamic army that bin Laden originally envisioned into a terrorist organization bent on attacking the United States, the last remaining superpower, and the force that bin Laden and Abu Hajar believed represented the greatest threat to Islam. Why did these men turn against America, a highly religious country that so recently had been their ally in Afghanistan? In large part, it was because they saw America as the locus of Christian power. Once the piety of the Muslim Mujahideen and the Christian leaders of the U.S. government had served as a bond between them. Indeed, Mujahideen leaders had been considerably romanticized in the American press and had made tours through American churches, where they were lauded for their spiritual courage in the common fight against Marxism and godlessness. But Christianity, especially the evangelizing American variety, and Islam were obviously competitive faiths. Viewed through the eyes of men who were spiritually anchored in the 7th century, Christianity was not just a rival, it was the arch-enemy. To them, the Crusades were a continual historical process that would never be resolved until the final victory of Islam. They bitterly perceived the contradiction embodied by Islam's long, steady retreat from the gates of Vienna, where on September 11th, that now resonant date, in 1683, the King of Poland began the battle that turned back the farthest advance of Muslim armies. For the next 300 years, Islam would be overshadowed by the growth of Western Christian societies. Yet bin Laden and his Arab Afghans believed that, in Afghanistan, they had turned the tide and that Islam was again on the march. Now they faced the greatest military, material, and cultural power any civilization had ever produced. Jihad against America? Some of the Al-Qaeda members asked in dismay. America knows everything about us. It knows even the label of our underwear. They saw how weak and splintered their own governments were, empowered only by the force of America's need to maintain the status quo. The oceans, the skies, even the heavens were patrolled by the Americans. America was not distant. It was everywhere. Al-Qaeda economists pointed to our oil that fueled America's rampant expansion, feeling as if something had been stolen from them. Not the oil exactly, although bin Laden felt it was underpriced, but the cultural regeneration that should have come with its sale. In the woefully unproductive societies they lived in, fortunes melted away like snow in the desert. What remained was a generalized feeling of betrayal. Of course, oil had brought wealth to some Arabs, but in the process of becoming rich, hadn't they only become more Western? Consumerism, vice, and individuality, which the radical Islamists saw as the hallmarks of modern American culture, threatened to destroy Islam, even the idea of Islam, by blending it into a globalized, corporate, interdependent, secular, commercial world that was part of what these men meant when they said America. But by defining modernity, progress, trade, consumption, and even pleasure as Western assaults on Islam, Al-Qaeda thinkers left little on the table for themselves. If America owned the future, the Islamic fundamentalists laid claim to the past. They were not rejecting technology or science. Indeed, many of the leaders of Al-Qaeda, such as Ayman al-Zawahiri and Abu Hajar, were men of science themselves. But they were ambivalent about the way in which technology weakened the spirit. This was reflected in bin Laden's interest in earth-moving machinery and genetic engineering of plants on the one hand, and his rejection of chilled water on the other. By returning the rule of Sharia, radical Islam could draw the line against the encroaching West. Even the values that America advertised as being universally desirable, democracy, transparency, the rule of law, human rights, the separation of religion from governance, were discredited in the eyes of the jihadis because they were Western and therefore modern. Al-Qaeda's duty was to awaken the Islamic nation to the threat posed by the secular, modernizing West. In order to do that, bin Laden told his men, Al-Qaeda would drag the United States into a war with Islam, a large-scale front which it cannot control. Indigenous Salafist movements were arising spontaneously across the Arab world and parts of Africa and Asia. These movements were largely nationalist, but they needed a place to organize. They found safe harbor in Khartoum, and naturally they mingled and learned from one another. Among these groups were the two main Egyptian organizations, Zawahiri's Al-Jihad and Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman's Islamic Group, as well as nearly every other violent radical group in the Middle East. The Palestinian group, Hamas, aimed to destroy Israel and replace it with a Sunni Islamist state. It was known for murdering Israeli citizens and torturing and killing Palestinians who it believed had been collaborating with Israel. Another Palestinian group, the Abu Nidal organization, was even more violent and rejectionist, having killed more than 900 people in 20 different countries, aiming mainly at Jews and moderate Arabs. Its best-known operations included the machine gunning of a synagogue in Vienna, the grenade attack on a Parisian restaurant, the bombing of a British Airways office in Madrid, the hijacking of an Egypt Air flight to Malta, and bloody attacks on the airports of Rome and Vienna. Hezbollah, which aimed to set up a revolutionary Shia state in Lebanon, had murdered more Americans than any other terrorist organization at the time. Sponsored by Iran, Hezbollah specialized in kidnapping and hijacking, although it was also responsible for a series of bombings in Paris. The most wanted terrorist in the world, Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez, known as Carlos the Jackal, also took up residence in Khartoum, posing as a French arms dealer. A Marxist and a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Carlos had kidnapped 11 members of the oil producers' cartel, OPEC, in Vienna in 1975, and flown them to Algiers for ransom. Having lost faith in communism, he now believed that radical Islam was the only force sufficiently ruthless to destroy America's cultural and economic dominion. Wanted all over the world, Carlos could easily be found in the mornings drinking coffee and eating croissants at Khartoum's Meridian Hotel. Although bin Laden distrusted Tarabi, hated him even, he experimented with one of Tarabi's most progressive and controversial ideas, to make common cause with Shiites. He had Abu Hajar advise the members of Al-Qaeda that there was only one enemy now, the West, and the two main sects of Islam needed to come together to destroy it. Bin Laden invited Shiite representatives to speak to Al-Qaeda, and he sent some of his top people to Lebanon to train with the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. Imad Magnia, the head of Hezbollah's security service, came to meet bin Laden and agreed to train members of Al-Qaeda in exchange for weapons. Magnia had planned the 1983 suicide car bombings of the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Marine Corps and French paratrooper barracks in Beirut, which killed more than 300 Americans and 58 French soldiers, and had led to the prompt withdrawal of American peacekeeping forces from Lebanon. That precedent had made a profound impression on bin Laden, who saw that suicide bombers could be devastatingly effective, and that, for all its might, America had no appetite for conflict. On December 29, 1992, a bomb exploded in the Movenpick Hotel in Aden, Yemen, and another blew up prematurely in the parking lot of a nearby luxury hotel, the Goldmohur. The bombers had targeted American troops who were on their way to Somalia to participate in Operation Restore Hope, the international famine relief effort. In fact, the soldiers were staying in a different hotel altogether. Bin Laden would later claim credit for this blundered attack, which was barely noticed in the United States, since no Americans died. The troops went on to Somalia as scheduled, but the triumphant leaders of Al-Qaeda told themselves that they had frightened the Americans away and scored an easy victory. And yet it had come at a price. Two people died, an Australian tourist and a Yemeni hotel worker, and seven others, mostly Yemenis, were severely injured. Behind the delirious, self-congratulatory chatter in Sudan, moral questions posed themselves, and members of Al-Qaeda began to wonder exactly what kind of organization they were becoming. One Thursday evening, Abu Hajar addressed the ethics of killing innocent people. He spoke to the men about Ibn Taymiyyah, a 13th century scholar who is one of the primary references for Wahhabi philosophy. In his day, Ibn Taymiyyah confronted the problem of the Mongols, who savaged Baghdad but then converted to Islam. Was it proper to take revenge against fellow Muslims? Ibn Taymiyyah argued that just because the Mongols had made the profession of faith, they were still not true believers, and therefore they could be killed. Moreover, as Abu Hajar explained to the 30 or 40 Al-Qaeda members who were sitting on the carpet in bin Laden's salon, propping their elbows on the bolsters and sipping mango juice, Ibn Taymiyyah had issued a historic fatwa. Anyone who aided the Mongols, who bought goods from them or sold to them or was merely standing near them, might be killed as well. If he is a good Muslim, he will go to paradise. If he is bad, he will go to hell, and good riddance. Thus the dead tourist and the hotel worker would find their proper reward. A new vision of Al-Qaeda was born. Abu Hajar's two fatwas, the first authorizing the attacks on American troops, and the second, the murder of innocents, turned Al-Qaeda into a global terrorist organization. Al-Qaeda would concentrate not on fighting armies, but on killing civilians. The former conception of Al-Qaeda as a mobile army of mujahideen that would defend Muslim lands wherever they were threatened was now cast aside in favor of a policy of permanent subversion of the West. The Soviet Union was dead, and communism no longer menaced the margins of the Islamic world. America was the only power capable of blocking the restoration of the ancient Islamic caliphate, and it would have to be confronted and defeated. Chapter 9. The Silicon Valley. In the early morning, when the sun hit the towers of the World Trade Center, the twin shadows stretched across the entire island of Manhattan. The object of the buildings was to be noticed. They were the two tallest towers in the world when they were finished in 1972 and 1973, a record that didn't last long, since architectural egos are always straining for the sky. Vanity was their most obvious quality. Otherwise, the buildings were bland and impractical. Tenants felt isolated. Just descending to earth and going out to lunch meant a time-consuming drop through several elevators and a brisk walk across the concourse to what was, finally, the welcome smell and clatter of the city. The tube construction that held up these stupendous stilts required columns spaced only 22 inches apart, which gave the impression, inside the offices, of being in a cage. But the vistas were glorious. The endless snake of lights on the New Jersey Turnpike, the bustling harbor with the diminutive Statue of Liberty, tankers and cruise ships slicing through the bending horizon of the Atlantic, the gray shores of Long Island, the trees beginning to turn in Connecticut, and recumbent Manhattan stretched out like a queen on her great bed between the rivers. Such momentous constructions are bound to intrude on the subconscious, as they are meant to do. Those awesome symbolic towers that speak of liberty, human rights, and humanity, as bin Laden labeled them. The most impressive view of the Trade Center was just across the Hudson River in Jersey City. There, in a neighborhood known as Little Egypt, followers of Omar Abdul Rahman, the blind sheikh, conspired to bring the towers down. Abdul Rahman was seeking asylum in the United States, despite being listed as a terrorist on the State Department watch list. As he had done in Egypt, he issued a fatwa in America that permitted his followers to rob banks and kill Jews. He traveled widely in the United States and Canada, arousing thousands of young immigrant Muslims with his sermons, often directed against Americans, who he said are descendants of apes and pigs, who have been feeding from the dining tables of the Zionist, communist, and colonialist. He called on Muslims to assail the West, cut the transportation of their countries, tear it apart, destroy their economy, burn their companies, eliminate their interests, sink their ships, shoot down their planes, kill them on the sea, air, or land. And indeed his followers were laboring to bring about this apocalypse. They hoped to paralyze New York by assassinating several political figures and destroying many of its most important landmarks: the George Washington Bridge, the Lincoln and Holland Tunnels, Federal Plaza, and the United Nations, in simultaneous bombings. They were reacting to American support for the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, whom they intended to kill when he came to New York. The FBI later learned that Osama bin Laden was financially backing the blind sheikh's efforts. Few Americans, even in the intelligence community, had any idea of the network of radical Islamists that had grown up inside the country. The blind sheikh may as well have been speaking in Martian as Arabic, since there were so few Middle East language specialists available to the FBI, much less to the local police. Even if his threats had been heard and understood, the perception of most Americans was dimmed by their general insulation from the world's problems and clouded by the comfortable feeling that no one who lived in America would turn against it. Then, on February 26, 1993, a rented Ford Econoline van entered the World Trade Center's massive basement parking garage. Inside the truck was Ramzi Youssef. It is unclear if bin Laden sent him, but he was a product of an Al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan, where he had learned his bomb craft. He had come to America to oversee the construction of what the FBI later determined was the largest improvised explosive device the Bureau had ever encountered. Youssef lit 4 20-foot-long fuses and fled to a vantage point just north of Canal Street from which he expected to see the buildings fall. Youssef was dark and slender, with one eye that wandered in its socket and burn marks on his face and hands, the result of accidental explosions. His real name was Abdelbaset Mahmoud Abdelkarim. The son of a Palestinian mother and Pakistani father, he had grown up in Kuwait City, then studied electrical engineering in Wales. He had a wife and child and another on the way in Quetta, the capital of the Pakistani province of Baluchistan. He was not a particularly devout Muslim. He was motivated mainly by his devotion to the Palestinian cause and his hatred of Jews. But he was the first Islamist terrorist to attack the American homeland. More important, his dark and grandiose imagination was the cocoon in which the movement would transform itself. Until Youssef arrived in America, the Brooklyn Cell had been experimenting with pipe bombs. It was Youssef's ambition and skill that radically changed the nature of terror. By placing the bomb in the southern corner of the garage, Youssef intended to topple one tower onto the other, bringing the entire complex down and killing what he hoped would be 250,000 people, a toll he thought equaled the pain the Palestinians had experienced because of America's support of Israel. He had hoped to maximize the casualties by packing the device, made of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, with sodium cyanide, or by making a dirty bomb with radioactive material smuggled out of the former Soviet Union, which would contaminate much of Lower Manhattan. The explosion blew through 6 stories of structural steel and cement, all the way down to the PATH train station below the garage and up to the Marriott ballroom above it. The shock was so great that tourists felt the ground shudder a mile away on Ellis Island. 6 people were killed and 1,042 were injured, generating the greatest number of hospital casualties of any event in American history since the Civil War. The towers shook and swayed, but the mighty buildings did not fall. When Louis Schelliro, the head of the FBI office in New York at the time, surveyed the 200-foot-wide crater in the subterranean heart of the mighty complex, he was astonished. He told a structural engineer, "This building will stand forever." Youssef flew back to Pakistan, and soon after that he moved to Manila. There he began concocting extraordinary schemes to blow up a dozen American airliners simultaneously, to assassinate Pope John Paul II and President